Welcome to the College Baseball Nation podcast. I'm your host, John Peters, joined by Kyle McKelvey. And this week on the podcast, we are recapping the MLB draft with guest Harris Frommer. Let's talk college baseball. Kyle, even though it's the offseason, it was a pretty big week in the college baseball world and the baseball world in general. And it's an equally big week on the College Baseball Nation social media world as we pit rivals against each other to see who can claim the title of biggest home field advantage in college baseball.
It is the dog days of summer, but don't tell college baseball Twitter fans because they are right in the middle of their prime voting, like voting on polls season.
Yeah, this is what midsummer is for. And there was an account that was like, why are these taking so long? It's like, well, like, what are you in the rush for? College baseball starts in 7 months. It's not
like we got
to fill the off season a little bit.
And for most people, college football is coming right out on the corner, so it's fine.
Yeah, it is wild that college football is around the corner. But like with all college sports, it seems like at this point, the news cycle is a year-round thing. And we have Harris that's going to be coming on just in a couple of moments to talk a little bit about the MLB draft. And so, I mean, we're both college baseball fans, but we follow Major League Baseball. We have our teams. We think we both care about the Rangers, and I have maybe the Giants and the Red Sox too that are on my radar. So as a fan of MLB, let's say, not just as a college baseball fan, what was your experience with the draft this year?
I was a little bit unplugged. It was right in the middle of a weird time of the schedule for me, but I saw, like you said, like the Rangers, I saw the Rangers got a steal, it felt like, going for Kumar Rocker, who wasn't able to get a deal done last season with the Mets, agreed to one this year. And it was weird seeing unaffiliated or whatever random school or independent team he's on now.
Yeah.
Like, he's Vanderbilt. It's Vanderbilt.
Yeah. Whenever I was doing the most teams, college teams with like the most picks in the first round, he was not on that tally, but it really felt like he should.
Yeah. And then I saw the highlights of him playing against some like part-time grocery baggers or whatever at independent league. And it was like, oh man, they don't stand a chance.
Yeah, and when he's throwing, it was 99. I think he touched with his fastball in Indy League, and his slider still looked good. So, yeah, as a Rangers fan, Rocker Leiter, what's the over-under on the number of years before both of those guys are in the rotation? Let's say, I'm going to put it at 2.5, that both of them are in the rotation. 2.5.
Under.
Under? You think they're going to be up faster?
Yeah, I mean, the Rangers have no starting pitching on their team. Like, I think we have one or two solid guys, and that's why we are currently under 500 overall, because that's not enough to have a solid rotation.
Yeah, Jack Leiter though is currently getting lit up in Double-A. I think his ERA is over six right now, but I don't think you take a guy's first year in minor leagues. As I don't know, they skipped several levels of professional baseball for him, threw him straight into Double-A. So I don't know, I think you look at his stuff at this point in his minor league development and he's still looking pretty good, but I don't know. I might take the over on 2.5 years before they both end up in the Rangers rotation, just because we'll see what ends up happening with Rocker's health, whether that issue in the Mets last year was a real thing or he's good to go.
Well, and yeah. And like the Rangers, I mean, this is not an MLB podcast, but the Rangers also really do, use their farm system well. So there's a good chance the overhits because they're not on the Rangers and they end up being used as trade bait.
Oh yeah. That would be very intriguing. I feel like those are some expensive guys though, especially Leiter right now.
Yeah. True. Yeah.
Leiter would only part ways with the Rangers if the Rangers are getting a, not just a rental at some point, like a multi-year guy for sure. Mm-hmm. All right. Though this feels like the perfect time to invite in our contributor, our MLB contributor. He's has really plugged into the draft, plugged into amateur baseball, minor league baseball all around. So let's welcome in Harris Frommer. Next up, we're welcoming Harris Frommer in to talk about the MLB draft. And last time we had you on, I think I said it'd been a year since we had you on. We made that gap a little bit shorter this time around now, just a week or so since you were last on the podcast, but welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Thanks again for having me, John. Very excited to talk about the draft. It was as promised. It was a fun evening on the 17th, and the 18th and 19th also didn't disappoint.
It was fun, and I was impressed. The MLB draft, at least on TV, the pomp and circumstance around it, the production value, I thought that it was a pretty good production as a whole. And it seems like from the league's perspective, it was a relatively successful event where a lot of those top first round type guys were actually there in person, and they were able to get reactions and things like that. So, I don't know if the MLB draft has quite the pomp and circumstance as some of the other drafts, but pretty successful event overall.
I'd agree with you. And also just the fact that it was in Tinseltown this year, I think added to the allure. It did feel like you had some elements of a Hollywood production. And like you said, it just added to the pomp and circumstance, and it was fun for viewers to watch.
Yeah, and successful even without the Dodgers having a pick until like 3 hours into the event or whatever it was. So we care about the college game, obviously, but professional baseball and college baseball have really strong connections, and what happens on draft night obviously has a huge implication for what happens in the next college season. And what are your general thoughts on some of the teams that are losers coming out of the MLB draft? I think one of the things that made headlines was five Vanderbilt signees getting drafted in the first round. But like you mentioned last time we were talking on the podcast, Vanderbilt kind of knew a lot of these guys were going. None of these were shocks. So is Vanderbilt a team that you're looking at as a loser from the draft, or was that kind of par for the course? Anyone else that had a really big hit from a draft perspective?
I would say the two teams that had the biggest hit from the draft perspective, John, would definitely be Vanderbilt. The other would be Texas. Vanderbilt, although, like I said, last time we spoke, that you know, the fact that you're going to lose some big guys is baked in. It's still, from a Vanderbilt perspective, it still stung. They knew they were going to lose Drew Jones. They knew Lesko was probably going to go. Barrera, Schultz was on the bubble. You know, in the weeks leading up to the draft, there was a lot of scuttlebutt that his number was too high and he'd ultimately end up in Nashville. So when he was taken on day one, or I should say in the first night, it was somewhat of a surprise. But, you know, when you're taking the first night, the likelihood of signing it is pretty high. And then when Ryan Clifford was taken in the 11th round by the Houston Astros, you know, that was somewhat of a surprise. I figured by the 11th round, if Clifford wasn't taken, the power hitting outfielder was going to end up in Nashville. But it looks like he's going pro. So that's quite a loss for Vanderbilt. Now, Texas didn't lose the number of guys that Vanderbilt lost, but they still was a bitter pill for Texas to swallow.
They're losing the heart and soul and Ivan Melendez. I mean, you knew he was going to be gone.
Oh, absolutely.
And it only got better from there.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, they, in terms of incoming freshmen, and again, Texas lost a bunch of guys, a bunch of, you know, stalwart players. So they were looking to replace them. But Henry Bolt being drafted by the A's, and then Cutter Coffey by the Red Sox, and Brenner Cox by the Washington Nationals. I mean, those guys, Cox has already signed. So has Coffey, as well as Bolt for $2 million to the A's. That's a bitter pill for them to swallow in Austin, because Texas really had its work cut out for him in replacing the guys who left.
So I have a theory about Vanderbilt specifically, and Texas might be able to be looped into this conversation. I'm convinced that the days of recruiting big classes in college baseball are largely over. I mean, maybe that's some hyperbole, but Vanderbilt has had a lot of success because they've been able to convince these top guys to come to campus. And like we talked about last time, NIL and things like that are still going to help them get some guys to campus. But I think that the transfer portal is playing such a large role in the college baseball game. And the transfer portal transfers maybe are a little bit more reliable. You have a little bit more comfort knowing if you're getting a freshman, for instance, transferring over, you at least have them guaranteed for a year, something like that. Do you think Vanderbilt is going to look at this draft and some drafts in the past, they've been kind of gutted in their recruiting class as a wake-up call? You think that we're going to see a Vanderbilt team that is more aggressive with the portal moving forward, or is this just a little bit of a blip for them?
That's a great question, John, because if you look at Vanderbilt's main competitor within the SEC, LSU, LSU was a lot more active in the transfer portal this summer than Vanderbilt was. And, you know, I was kind of surprised that Vanderbilt wasn't nearly as active as LSU was. Maybe it has something to do with academic requirements. I don't know. That would be a good question to ask someone intimately familiar with the Vanderbilt program. But you make a great point in that Vanderbilt's recruiting class really took a hit, you know, during a 3-day draft, during a three-day draft period. And, you know, they're behind the eight ball as we sit here right now. So that's a great question. Maybe they will have to readjust their strategy starting next year, recalibrate their strategy starting next year. But they're definitely behind LSU as of July 26, 2022.
Oklahoma also had a ton drafted. I think they won, if you want to go by that.
Whole rotation, right?
Yeah, they had 11 drafted. So if you want to count that as a winning, sure. But if you want to go from the college side, that's a lot of talent to lose to date. I mean, I don't know. It seems to have, they had one first-round draft pick and a few scattered throughout the rest. Did they? What do you think of this OU haul?
Do you mean from a draft perspective, or do you mean from a or do you mean from who they have coming in?
I meant from the draft perspective, yeah.
Yeah,
well, I mean, you can't talk about the Oklahoma draft without talking about Cade Horton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Horton, you know, there was a lot. I mean, he was probably the biggest wild card in the entire draft. You know, there was talk, obviously, a month and a half before the draft, people were saying, you know, he was probably not even a day one pick. But then as the season wound down and he was lights out every time he took the mound, that changed.
And before they updated it, the MLB top draft prospects, he wasn't in the top 200 before the week before the draft.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right, John. And so, you know, I think the staff at Oklahoma was probably very excited or very optimistic, I should say, you know, up until the final weeks. That if nothing else, Horton was probably going to be coming back to campus because his high dollar figure would not be met. But obviously, because of his outstanding performance down the stretch, that changed. And now, you know, not only does Oklahoma have to look for an entirely new pitching staff, weekend rotation, but they also have to find a Friday night ace as well, and that's going to be tough to do.
Can I follow up a little bit on Oklahoma, because I kind of felt like Peyton Graham was going to go a little bit higher because is there any reason why someone like Horton got the College World Series boost, but Peyton Graham didn't as much? Did he just not do anything that he hadn't already done throughout the rest of the year at the College World Series? Or I felt like he slipped a little later in the first round than I would have guessed.
That's a great question. And I spoke to some scouts about Peyton Graham. As a Tigers fan, I have a vested interest in this. A couple things with Peyton Graham. So first of all, he started off the season slowly, and his strikeouts were up and his walks were down. And people took notice of that. You know, that was their first impression this year. And, you know, he started off behind the eight ball. Second is his physique. He's about 6'3", 6'4", 175, 180 pounds, if that. And there are some teams who feel he'll have trouble because of that frame adding good weight. And that may hamper his power going forward. And, you know, the other thing is this was a pretty loaded class from a college position player perspective. And teams felt other guys, such as Brooks Lee, such as Gavin Crosso, and so forth, were more of a sure bet than Peyton Graham. And as a result, he was available a little lower than most people thought he would be. But I think Peyton Graham, I've heard people compare him to Trey Turner. Now, I'm not saying he's going to be that type of player, but he has some of the physical attributes that Trey Turner has, and he could be a very, very intriguing talent as he moves up the minor league chain, and approaches the major leagues. But you're right. I mean, I would have guessed that he, instead of going in the low 50s, he would have probably gone. He was probably more of a bet to go 20 picks higher, call it, maybe even more, end of the first round. But you know, instead he was there and the Tigers signed him to a slightly above slot deal.
So we've talked some about losers. Have any takes on, from a college perspective, which teams were big winners, who got out of the draft, with either some freshmen coming to campus or some draft eligible guys returning with extra college eligibility.
I have to say, even with the haul they took in, you know, during the transfer, you know, with all the transfers, LSU comes out of this a winner. Because first of all, Paxton Kling could have a very similar impact next spring that Dylan Cruz had in 2021. He's that good of a talent. And then on top of that, they have other guys coming to campus, such as Brady Neal, the catcher, Gavin Guidry, the two-way player, infielder, right-handed pitcher, Jaden, I think he pronounces it Newt, Jaden Newt, the right-handed pitcher, as well as Chase Shores. That's a pretty good haul. And, you know, that will augment their existing team very nicely. And a couple of other teams I really like with some of the talent they have they're bringing in. Louisville with Gavin Killeen, the shortstop from Wisconsin, Corbin Dickerson, the outfielder, as well as a couple of hard-throwing right-handed pitchers. And finally, UCLA has a couple of intriguing outfielders coming in. At one point, Peyton Brennan, outfielder from California, left-handed hitter, he was viewed as a possible first around town. He's a very interesting case. He was hurt summer of 2021, and then he started off like gangbusters this year. There's a lot of scuttlebutt that he would be, that he could sneak his way into the first round. Then he got hurt again. But, you know, if he's healthy beginning of next year, he could play a significant role for the Bruins. And finally, Keenan Proctor, who's another outfielder with an intriguing skill set, he could also see a lot of playing time next year. So even though UCLA lost Thatcher Hurd and lost a couple incoming freshmen to the draft, so most notably J.R. Ritchie, they should do pretty well next year.
Yeah, it's always interesting. And Savage always does a great job at UCLA of reloading, consistently pulling in top classes. He must just know how to, maybe he's lucky, or maybe he knows how to build the class just right so that he has scholarships to go around for the guys who end up on campus. I want to add another name in there that I don't think they, I mean, I can say certainly did not have the high-end talent in the MLB draft, but had a lot of guys who could have gone, and I'm going to throw in Texas A&M into this list because they had several of these big-time contributors down the stretch for their College World Series run who are going to be coming back. So they lose Clonch and Dylan Rock, Micah Dallas, Moo Menifee. But they have Minnick coming back and Trevor Werner and some guys who might have been able to either sign or to get drafted somewhere in the towards the end of the draft. So that'll be interesting to see how A&M does with some of that more senior leadership.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, a lot of us, me included, we get very excited when there are guys on a team who look like they have a long pro career ahead of them, you know, that look like they could be major league contributors at the major league level. But those are not always the teams that win college baseball. A lot of times it's the teams that don't have the quote unquote sexy players. It's the teams that have, you know, 4-year seniors or even 5th-year guys.
Yeah, just the professional college players.
Exactly. The guys like that bring the experience with them. Those are often the teams that play late into June.
So we've talked a lot about what's the draft from the college perspective. And I want to talk a little bit about from the major league perspective, because there were some interesting things. There's always interesting things in the draft. Like we discussed, it's always hard as a casual fan to exactly follow what teams are doing with pool money. But what better way to get a little bit of insight into what happens in front offices than trying to break down what the Rangers did with Rocker? So I knew heading into the draft to expect Rocker's name pretty high. I don't know if anyone thought he was going to go at number 3 to the Rangers. Can you give us a little bit of insight into how he's actually now signed? So we have some information about that number. And can you give us a little bit of insight into how the Rangers pulled off this underslot deal with Rocker?
Because both of us are Rangers fans.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we talked about it before you got on. We both have vested interest in the Rangers, and we're trying to figure out what the heck the Rangers pulled off with this.
Yeah, that was a very interesting scenario, and a couple things to unpack with that, guys. The first is, who's Rocker's agent? It's Scott Boras. And Scott Boras likes
Packers. Ding, ding, ding.
Yes. He likes the package players. And a couple of things to remember here. So Rocker signed, I believe the number he signed for was $5.2 million. Slot at that level, third pick overall, was in the sevens. So the Rangers signed Rocker for a discount of over $2 million. What did they do with that money? They signed Brock Porter. They drafted and signed Brock Porter, who they took him in the fourth round. They didn't have a second or third rounder because they signed Kyle Seager and Marcus Semien as free agents. Who is Brock Porter's agent? Scott Boras. So my very educated guess, or I should say well-informed guess, is that the Rangers sat down and Boras made a deal with them. He said, if you take Rock, now remember, Rock was drafted last year by the Mets, and the number he agreed on with the Mets before all the talk about his injury history came up, was the number they agreed on was around $5.1 million. So the Rangers signed Rocker for slightly more than the amount he agreed on with the Mets last year. And so that enabled, you know, Boras and Rocker to save face. And not only that, with the money they saved, the Rangers saved, they went and they scooped up another Boras client, Brock Porter. So, you know, at the end of the day, everybody was happy, but it's just a reminder of how Scott Boras does business. I definitely did not have that on my bingo card. I did not think the Orioles were going to draft Jackson Holliday. I was almost certain. In fact, I tweeted a couple hours before the draft that the one pick I was most comfortable, one prediction I was most comfortable with was Jackson Holliday going to the Rangers 3. I figured the Rangers were going to go, the Orioles were going to go well under slot at 1-1, thereby freeing up Drew Jones to go to the Diamondbacks second overall, which he in fact did, and that the Rangers were going to be waiting, lurking at 3 and snatch up Holliday there. But instead, the Orioles threw a wrench in all of our plans by taking Holliday 1-1. And I guess that left the Rangers exposed, and they had a deal in place with Boras to snap up Rocker at a well below slot amount of $5.2 or so million dollars. So that's what happened. Very shocking. I'm not in love with that with that strategy. I think that the Rangers, when making that third overall pick, they were thinking more about what they were going to do in the fourth round than what they did in the first round. And I think at 3, you have to take the best overall player. And I think there were a number of guys far, far better at 3, far safer at 3 than Kumar Rocker. Now, Kumar Rocker is a tremendous pitcher. He had a lot of success as an amateur, both in high school and at Vanderbilt. But I just think that at that level, third overall, there were guys that would have been better picks.
Do you think the Rangers' timeline plays into that sort of pick at all? I think that they're not contenders now, but the Rangers have to imagine that if they're going to have a window, it's going to be in a few years. And similarly, if Rocker's going to make it to the big leagues, we'll probably have a pretty good idea in the same couple of years. So is there any sort of consideration like that the Rangers might have done?
I think you're right, John. I mean, you know, they say you should never draft, you know, the 11th commandment is thou shalt never draft for need in baseball. And I think sometimes teams break that. I think the Rangers kind of did that here. They not only drafted for need, but I think they're looking at a timeline as well, which is something you probably shouldn't do either. Here's the thing. If they were drafting for need, or if they're drafting, you know, with one eye on a timeline, I think there were better guys coming out of college. There were guys that were a better fit for that organization coming out of college than Rocker. What I think happened is they looked at Brock Porter and they he was very alluring to them. And they just fell in love with the idea of taking Brock Porter in the fourth round. In order to do that, they needed a guy at a deep discount at third overall, and that guy was Rocker.
And now, because he got drafted in the fourth round, Porter, though, is not, let's say, air quote, fourth round talent, though, right? He was a guy that probably had other teams reaching out to him at some point between then and the first and the fourth round, talking to him, seeing if he's willing to take it, and he's probably given them some number that no other team could match because he had this deal arranged with the Rangers. Is that a reasonable take on how this went?
Oh, for sure. I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when it wasn't as taboo for teams to take a high school right-hander at the top of the draft or early in the draft, I think Porter's a top, if not a top 10, then definitely a top 15 guy. But, you know, in the last 5, 7, 10 years, we've seen a shift in the paradigm. A lot of teams are very hesitant to take high school pitchers, especially high school right-handers, you know, top 10 or top dozen. But yeah, Porter to me, and as much as I dislike taking high school right-handers early, high school left-handers for that matter as well, he was a top, easily a top 20 talent. Goes without saying.
So one side of the coin, maybe the Rangers looking too much at their timeline and didn't get the most out of their first round pick. Other side of the coin is maybe the Rangers got 2 first round picks with their first and fourth rounder. So I guess this will be a little bit of a time we'll tell. If Rocker pans out, then the Rangers will look great. And if not, then we'll be watching as other teams have guys bringing up, getting called up, and they'll have their regrets.
That's a great way of looking at it, John. It's very look. Kumar Rocker is a great pitcher. Brock Porter was a great high school pitcher, but they're pitchers, and Rocker already has an injury history. Excuse me, and the attrition rate for high school right-handers is through the roof. So it's from a skills or from I should say from a talent perspective, they most certainly got 2 first rounders, but you know, looking at the attrition rate of that demographic, especially high school right-handers, it's doubtful that at the end of the day, both guys will fulfill the lofty expectations placed on them.
At that point, you just need darts to the dartboard, right? So the Rangers definitely need pitching depth in the majors. And obviously this is maybe a few years away, like y'all been talking about, but yeah, just any number of darts will help. And I guess this is a pretty good setup to maybe get one of them at least. We'll see. They have plenty of money. They just keep throwing it. Like infielders, they threw $500 million at infielders. Yeah. So we'll see.
So if the Rangers had, let's say, a high risk, high reward draft, who in your mind was more of a traditional successful draft from an MLB perspective?
Well, you know, so a couple of weeks, not even 2 weeks out, it's very hard to say, you know, who had a successful draft and who didn't. But there were 3 drafts that really caught my eye. The first were the Orioles. And I love everything that front office has done since taking over after, I think, the 2018 season. I don't believe they've taken a pitcher yet in the top 4 rounds, or at least the top 3 rounds in any one of the 4 drafts they've led. This year was no different. They started off, like we said earlier, taking Jackson Holliday 1-1. Jackson Holliday may end up being another Gunnar Henderson. I mean, a left-handed hitting shortstop with a great hit tool, with size, ability to stick at the position, runs well, obviously has the Bud lines. He's Matt Holliday's son. He could end up moving really quickly through the minor leagues and then being an impact player at the major league level. And then at 33 overall, they take Dylan Beavers, who, you know, some would argue should have gone 10, 15 picks higher. He's your prototypical right fielder. He's got a cannon for an arm, lots of power, runs very well, can take a walk. And then they took Max Wagner, who's the ACC player of the year in the second round, Clemson, third baseman from Clemson, who hits bombs. Very well in the North. Excuse me?
Hits bombs. 27.
Oh, he's unbelievable. Right? Oh, absolutely. And you know, he does not turn 21 until late August. He's a sophomore sign. And then in the competitive balance round, following the pick of Wagner, they take Judd Fabian, who I think if the Orioles player development system, like once they get their hands on him, he could explode. And he's a guy they took with their 4th pick. And, you know, he had success at the college level. I mean, I don't know how many home runs he hit in his 4 years at Florida combined. But, I mean, he's got 60 to 70 grade power. He's at least a 60, 65 fielder in center field. Runs well, can take a walk. If they can limit the swing and miss in his game, he could be a very intriguing player at the big league level. So that's the Orioles, a draft that I really liked. And then
I want to ask you a little bit about Holliday. You said that Holliday, you were surprised. I think a lot of people were surprised that Holliday was taken by the Orioles because he kind of was seen as what the best player, maybe one of the best players, and a lot of people saw the Orioles going under slot there. Is it an outside than ordinary thing for the Orioles to take what they see as the best player? Is this a change in perspective, or is this kind of just another version of what the Orioles have always been doing?
Well, the rule of thumb with Mike Elias, the Orioles GM, is this. When there's been a clear-cut top of the board talent in the draft, Elias has taken him. Case in point, Adley Rutschman, 2019. And I think it's fair to say the Orioles have been very happy with the way that's turned out. However, and you know, fortunately, or I should say unfortunately for him, Elias, the Orioles have been in this predicament a lot, picking very early, either first, second, fifth, you know. When there hasn't been a top flight, or I should say a unanimous top talent available, Elias has then taken someone who he's drafted someone who will take a deal, an underslot deal, and then he'll spread the money around. Case in point, Colton Cowser last year, Heston Kjerstad in second overall 2020. And that has also worked out very, very well for the Orioles. And this year, there were a number of, you know, although Drew Jones was seen as the consensus top talent in the draft this year, it was not unanimous. And there were some people who felt that Jackson Holliday was at least in the conversation. And because of that, and there were also a couple other players who also were in the conversation. So because of that, I think most people felt pretty confident that Mike Elias at the end of the day was going to make an underslot deal. My prediction was that he was going to make an underslot deal with Tamar Johnson, the high school second baseman who was the ASU commit, who Pittsburgh eventually took fourth overall. But so that was my guess. Obviously, I was wrong. And the Orioles went with Holliday. I mean, there was a connection there. So I believe Mike Elias, prior to working with the Astros, was in the St. Louis Cardinals organization while Matt Holliday was an outfielder there. So that might have played a role. I don't know. But suffice to say, I was pretty surprised that's how things played out on draft night.
All right, so we have the Orioles, and you said there's a couple other teams that you were impressed by?
Right. There were two other teams I was impressed with their draft. The second was the Royals. Now, this draft didn't make waves, but I think they got really good value the first and second round and again in the sixth round. First round, I took Gavin Cross. I'll admit, I'm high guy here, and I'm high man on Gavin Cross. But when I see Gavin Cross, I see a very physical player who could play in the middle of the field, who can play center field. He's got a potent lefty bat. He posted tremendous exit velocities. He really improved his swing decisions. And, you know, he went 9 overall. I would not have been shocked had he gone into mid-single digits. I think that was a great place for him to go. And again, the Royals, Kansas City is another organization with a phenomenal player development program when it comes to hitting. If you look at the success, guys like Nick Prado, Bobby Witt Jr., Vinny Pasquantino have had, since joining the organization, it becomes pretty evident that Cross should have a nice path ahead of him. And the other guy, the other pick I really liked was Caden Wallace at 49. Now, you know, Kyle mentioned a couple minutes ago, Peyton Graham, who I think went 51. I view Caden Wallace in the same light. Caden Wallace is a guy who easily could have gone 20 picks earlier. Power hitting third baseman, a guy who can definitely stick at the position. He's got a very compact swing. He had a strikeout rate much lower than Graham's, and he did it in the SEC. I believe Caden Wallace's strikeout rate was in the 16-17% range. And like I said, he played a very strong very strong third base. I think you get a guy like Caden Wallace in that player development system, and he could become an impact major leaguer.
I like it. Hogs fans will like to hear that too. And I think it's interesting to see these guys who are, I think a lot of the guys you just mentioned in the last couple of breaths have been guys who are really, really strong defensive guys that I think will, the very least, it feels like a lot of these guys could end up as bench utility guys, call-ups late in the year for maybe a playoff run, something like that in the next few years, because their defense will play And hopefully their bat will develop soon after.
For sure. And the last team I liked, the third team, was the Twins. So three American League teams we're highlighting here. And again, the Twins are similar to the Royals in that I really liked some of the value they got early on. I mean, I never would have envisioned Brooks Lee lasting till pick eight. I mean, Brooks Lee is a guy who hit over 400 in the Cape Cod League last summer. Nobody does that. I mean, that is phenomenal. And he, I mean, there are scouts who have assigned a 70 hit tool to Brooks Lee. And he's a, I guess the best comp I've heard on him is a mid 2000s version of Carlos Guillen, you know, the guy who played shortstop for the Tigers about 15, 20 years ago. Lee's a physical switch hitter. He'll probably begin his career as a shortstop. We'll see if he sticks there. If not, he'll be an above average third baseman. But for the Twins to get him at eight, I mean, that was a coup. And then with the 48th overall pick in the second round, they got Connor Prelip. And I think any fan of the SEC is pretty familiar with Prelip, who was lights out his freshman year prior to the pandemic. Got hurt last year, had to undergo Tommy John surgery, and threw a couple bullpens in the run-up to the draft this year. I mean, Prelip is a physical lefty. He's about 6'2", 6'3", 210 pounds. He's been clocked in the mid-90s. He's got a high spin slider. He's got a decent changeup. He has featured strong command and control. I mean, Prelip was being discussed in the low teens, even the high single digits, and there the Twins ended up getting him at 48. I mean, it's very possible that at the end of the day, the Twins will end up with the best college position player as well as the best college pitcher, and that's quite a haul.
Yeah, you had some good words to say about him in your write-up that we put on our mock draft. Like, it came out right before the draft, and you actually fit him to the Tigers. And so I don't know, he must have really wanted him if you put him into your own team.
You know, there was a lot of talk the week or two before the draft that the Tigers had a lot of interest in Prelip. I know they had a heavy contingent, a large contingent, including GM Al Avila, at his second bullpen session at the combine. Mm. And a lot of people, you know, intimately familiar with the Tigers, were convinced Prelip was going to be their pick. And I think at the end of the day, the Tigers realized, you know, the Tigers have the worst offense in Major League Baseball. And I just think that the Tigers brain trust realized they needed a bat, and instead they opted for Chase Young, who, you know, tremendous hitter, should be a second baseman in the big leagues. But, you know, I a lot of people thought Prelip was going to be their guy.
So with every MLB draft, there's always one or two guys who deal just doesn't work. They don't sign. Last year, most prominently, Kumar Rocker, very high draft pick, doesn't sign. But we also know that 98% of guys who get picked in the first 10 rounds end up signing. So most of these guys, these prominent guys, are going to sign, and a lot of them already have at this point. Is there anyone on your radar, as rumors are, or that he's going to end up at college?
No, you know, like I said, the draft is so different now than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, that teams, there's such a high degree of certainty on the part of teams who's going to sign, you know, and for what amount of money, unless there's a health issue involved, like we saw last year with Kumar Rocker. And, you know, this year with the combine and the medical exams that were performed at the combine, you know, I see very little room for surprises. I guess I could throw out a couple guys who I'm not certain, a top 10 round, so I'm not certain they will sign, but they probably will. The one name that comes to mind is Tommy Specht, who your Rangers drafted in the sixth round. He's a very physical, very toolsy outfielder, I believe from Iowa. He has a Kentucky commitment, left-handed hitter. You know, I think his bat tool is behind some of his other tools right now. And he's probably a guy who might be better off going to college. But again, in this day and age, you know, the Rangers spending a sixth-round pick on him, I would be surprised if he doesn't go pro. But he's the type of guy who might opt for college. But again, it's doubtful. I'm pretty certain he goes pro, but he's one. I wouldn't be shocked if he went to college. But at the end of the day, it's probably not going to happen.
I'm sure Kentucky fans would love that, to get a top 10 round kind of guy on campus.
Yeah, he'd be a great fit for the program, that's for sure.
Well, Harris, thanks for all of your insights. The MLB draft is always just a total mystery. And it is fascinating to see how it turns out. Draft night always has its curveballs, and I think you did a great job of breaking them down for us and explaining them on Twitter. One last thing before you go. 2023 MLB draft. You have the first overall pick. You're the GM and you get that pick. Who are you picking right now if you had to?
If the draft, that's a great question. If the draft is tonight.
Yeah.
GM,
you're on the clock right now.
and I'm the GM of the team who wins the lottery. And just remember, this is going to be the first year, 2023 is going to be the first year in which there's a draft lottery.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I will say I'm probably not going to take Dylan Cruz. I'm probably going to take Max Clark, high school center fielder from Indiana. I saw him in Cary last month, and I think he's got the best combination of tools and performance out there. And I think the college class is loaded. But I think right now, as we sit here talking today on the 26th of July, Matt Clark's my guy.
All right. Well, we'll save this audio clip, send it over to you. And if in a year he gets picked one overall, you can post this for the world to see that you were that you foresaw it all. And if not, we'll just forget about this.
And we'll probably end up forgetting about it because so much changes between now and you know, so much will change in the next 51 weeks. That's for sure.
All right. Well, thanks again so much for joining us, Harris.
Thanks for having me, John. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the College Baseball Nation podcast. If you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it right now. Also, check out our social media at College Ball Matt. We're on Instagram and Twitter. And check out our website, collegebaseball.info. Thanks, and have a great week.